Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
This is DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg.
Lots going on this weekend for a COVID-19 sports weekend. I mean, some golf, some NASCAR, The Last Dance again. So a lot going on. Chris Canty, how was your weekend? You have a nice weekend?
It was really good, Dave. A lot of live sports. I mean, we had the UFC fight on Saturday night. We had the golf yesterday where Ricky Fowler dazzled everybody with his wedge game. But, you know, listen, The Last Dance is probably the icing on the cake for this weekend. And I got to tell you, Dave, it didn't disappoint with the last couple of episodes. It was awesome.
Yeah, it was really, really well done. Whether you liked Jordan or you didn't like Jordan, you got an insight into what made him tick a little bit. And Rick, how are you? You have a nice weekend, a lovely weekend?
I had a lovely weekend, Dave. I mean, till this morning, but I mean, we'll get into that whole thing later. I don't want to talk about it. I'm a little bit frustrated, a little bit upset, but
really?
A little flood. We had a little flood situation in the
was
kitchen.
Was there a toilet clog?
No, there was no, you know, me with the plunger, Dave. I mean, you're
talking about but you don't live alone. I mean, someone else could clog a toilet.
Yeah, but usually if the toilet's clogged, I'm the one that they call because of, you know, my past successes.
yes.
That toilet, by the way, is terrific.
Evidenced on the show, yes.
No, water filter. This morning around 4:30, I went down, flooded, was just spitting water all over the place because someone thought it was a great idea. I don't want to name names, but to put the actual filter in with the bubble wrap still on it, still on the actual filter.
Well, so here's the thing. I'm thinking that your children 5 and under are not those people.
No, I was not one of the people. My wife was not one of the people. Yeah. So this was a third party that was involved. Mm-hmm. So not only is the kitchen flooded, turns out, because Cass actually took it apart to see what was going on, not only did it flood the kitchen, it also flooded, you know, the basement because it went through the basement ceiling.
So you have a real issue on your hands now.
We got a real issue. Here's the best part, which, of course, is Cassie's bigger concern, and now she's WebMDing and everything else.
Mold.
Is that exactly right. So I've been drinking moldy water for God knows how long. Yeah.
Mold, yeah.
So forget the flood. It's that, I mean, I could be potentially sick for some reason because I've been drinking moldy water. For who knows how long.
Oh, my goodness.
Very concerned.
Well, we'll revisit this later in the show because I know it's a topic that everyone wants to hear about. But I think The Last Dance might be something that's up there as well. And all right, so let me ask you this question to start out the show. 800-919-3776 as well. What is your lasting memory, right? We saw 10 hours of it, 10 episodes, all very well done. Even the worst of the episodes was still really, really well done. What would you say, Chris, was your one lasting memory or one thing that you learned or just the one piece of information that you gleaned from this 10-part event?
Well, I mean, I think that what the documentary did was it showed us the depth of Michael Jordan's personality, and I don't think anybody realized how much he really cared about his teammates and the people that were around him. Like, when it went into detail about Gus, the guy that was the head of his security detail, and just how he had that relationship where he could reach out to him in the middle of the night, and Gus would come to him, and you know, they could cry together and that kind of thing. When Gus was going through cancer, Michael Jordan was there for him. And then we saw a couple of episodes ago where Michael Jordan got emotional and talking about how he pushed his teammates to try to play the way that he did and ultimately probably alienated some folks that he wanted to have good relationships with. It just shows us the human side of this guy that we've deified just based on what we saw him do with the repeat three-peat in the 90s. So, I mean, it's just... You know about Michael Jordan, the athlete, but you actually got a chance to see the human side of him through this docuseries. And I got to say, Dave, it just adds to his legend.
Yeah, but the best part, though, Chris, is not even just us as fans and spectators, people that got a chance to, you know, watch Michael Jordan. I mean, you're talking about some of the greatest players of all time that looked at Jordan the same way that we as fans did. I mean, how about Reggie Miller calling him Black Jesus? Or no, Jordan calling himself Black Jesus. I mean, he really was... He got to a level in the sport where, I mean, when I was done watching it last night, I mean, I felt like Michael Jordan was like, he's the Don of the NBA. Like, as long as you, I mean, paid your proper respects, you were fine. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, I mean, he would rip you apart. I mean, how about Karl Malone actually taking the time to go on the bus after losing to shake his hand and congratulate him?
Well, you saw that a lot. You saw Larry Bird do it. I mean, you saw, you know, because we always say hockey's the one sport that they shake hands at center ice, which it's true, but it seems like basketball has a little bit of that as well, just kind of behind the scenes where you kind of seek out the other players and say good series and appreciate what you
did. Well, guys, after you saw what Michael Jordan did to Isaiah Thomas and keeping him off the Dream Team, can you blame those guys? Can you blame Larry Bird, who was coaching the Pacers in that Eastern Conference Finals? What was that, 98, 97, 98? Could you blame them for going to talk to Jordan after the game? Like, he commanded that kind of respect, and if you didn't show him that kind of respect, then it was going to be a problem for you, not for him.
I just thought, I thought it was amazing. I mean, they have the one clip of Malone and Stockton, like, sitting there waiting to say good game, shake his hand. Larry Bird comes and congratulates him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you heard what Larry Bird said when he went to congratulate him, too?
Yeah, how about what Jordan said to Larry Bird?
I know.
What it was, what Jordan said to Bird.
Oh, man. I mean, dude, I'm telling you what, 10 hours is not enough. Like, I could have watched easily another 10 hours of that.
Well, if I told you that was going to be like a TV show, like it was going to be in seasons and you were going to have 10 seasons of that, of 24 episodes, you'd sign on for that right now. It was riveting television.
Can you think of another athlete or another team that could do, that they could do a documentary on that you would be that captivated in?
You know, it's fun. That captivated, I don't know. But if you said what other guys would move the needle that I think people would be interested in, I think Mike Tyson would be interesting like that.
Top of the list for me.
I think Tiger Woods would be very interesting.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that the 86 Mets team, like if you took a deep
as
dive
a team,
into that,
yeah,
as a team would be good.
Because that
the Patriots
was a disaster. Yeah, Tom Brady or the Patriots or Belichick.
I think, like, Belichick would be really good, yeah.
Like, you could, and granted, he might be bland and boring, but I don't know. I would love to see, because you actually had access to Michael Jordan. If you had access to these guys and saw what made them tick and what kind of people they were like behind the scenes, I think it'd be fascinating.
Yeah, but you know what? I think Chris brings up a great point, because I don't think anyone had any idea. I mean, you saw the security walking around Jordan, but then you get an idea of who Gus was and what he meant to Michael Jordan. I mean, my takeaway from that was that, like, Michael Jordan, I always tell you, and Chris agrees with me, I mean, when you're going to be that kind of leader, you make a conscious decision every single day to be a leader and be a certain kind of way. Like, Jordan went out of his way to show no weaknesses, to show no emotion. But, I mean, and I think you realize that because, I mean, there were people in his life that he would be just regular Michael Jordan to, that he wouldn't be afraid to cry in front of. You know what I mean? Like, that couldn't be easy. Like, keeping that all pent up every single day in front of your teammates?
No, I'm sure not.
That's a lonely existence, man.
Yeah, and you have to keep it up, right? I mean, you can't let it go at any point, because then all of a sudden there's a crack.
And that's the thing, Dave. That's hard to do, to have to be on all the time when you're around your teammates, to not be able to show any weaknesses, to project strength just so they have that kind of confidence. That's hard to do. But, I mean, we actually had a chance to listen to Michael Jordan talk about it. He said there's a cost to winning. There's a cost to leadership, and he was willing to pay that. That's why I don't understand why people are saying, you know, things about Jordan and criticizing his leadership style and all of that stuff. Because I just think, based on what we saw him do and based on the level of success that they were able to have, how can you say what was or what wasn't necessary in terms of how he handled his teammates and what he did from a leadership standpoint?
Well, I guess the ultimate answer is, did it work or not? And the answer here is, yeah, it worked.
That's what I'm saying.
Won 6 championships. So even if you don't like some of the things he did, it's hard to argue that it was ineffective. I mean, it worked. He won 6 titles.
Well, I guess that's my point, Dave. That's why I don't understand the point of being critical of what Michael Jordan did from a leadership standpoint and how he talked to his teammates. I mean, is there another way to do it? Probably. But that was the way that he knew. And so that's what he had to do. And they were able to have success at the highest levels. How often can we say that you had a guy that won his first championship and then after that all he did was win championships? Like, you can't say that really about anybody else's career. Think about that. High-level athletes, star players, when they win their first championship, having the opportunity for the rest of their career, all they did was win championships.
Yep.
That's what we saw from Michael Jordan. Once he figured out what it was all about, once he was able to get a taste of that championship DNA, he found a way to be able to replicate that. He found a way to build that into the culture that was the 90s Chicago Bulls. And now you talk about them as one of the iconic franchises in the NBA, along with the Celtics, along with the Lakers. And when you flash back to that clip when he was drafted back in 84, and they're talking about, yeah, you know, I just want to make sure that the organization is respected like those other teams. And he actually accomplished that. That's incredible to me, Dave. It really is. The guy set out to become the best basketball player in the world, and he went out and did it.
Yeah, that's true. And the thing that I kind of, and I knew it, but you see these stories and you watch it in depth of just what a savage he was to win. Like the fact that he would lie to himself about things that didn't really happen just to motivate him. I mean, that's, I don't think it's normal, and it just shows you how unusual a athlete this guy, in fact, was. I mean, he made up a story about LeBradford Smith saying, good game, Mike, and that's kind of thrown throughout the documentary that he had to find new and inventive ways to motivate himself to keep himself, you know, fresh and on edge. It's remarkable to me.
Dave, how about the one with Brian Russell? When Jordan is retired and the Jazz are coming to Chicago to play, and he walks into the practice facility to say what's up to all the guys.
Yeah.
And Brian Russell is like, well, why did you retire? I could have got at you. I wanted to play against you. And he was like, all right, put that guy on the list.
Yep, put him on. And then George Karl, right? George Karl doesn't say, hey, Mike, we're Carolina guys. What's going on at a restaurant? But if George Karl does do that and walks up and says, Mike, I love you, whatever, Dean Smith, no, whatever we have to say, then he's going to be, how dare he speak to me? Like, whatever it was, he's going to find a way to motivate against you.
You didn't want to be Michael Jordan's opponent, Dave. That's what it comes down to. There was nothing that you could do to make you be on the right side of that. It was going to be all bad for you. And I think that's attributed to Michael Jordan being a top competitor. I mean, the top competitors always find a way to motivate themselves. They don't rely on external motivation. They do it internally, but Michael Jordan found a way to continue to put that chip on his shoulder, and he would take any little thing that could be perceived as a slight and use that in order to push him to get to that level. That's special, man. Not everybody has that.
I think very few have that.
Because mentally, you just can't keep that up, Dave. Like, mentally, it's virtually impossible to have yourself that motivated every single day. I mean, most athletes, even the greatest athletes, I mean, Scottie Pippen said it. I needed Michael Jordan to be that bad guy. Most great athletes need the coach to be that bad guy, to push everybody, to hold everybody accountable, to make it. I mean, you had, you know, Scottie Burrell on today saying, you know, the games are easy. It was practice that was hard, because he would yell at us and push us. That's usually what the coach does. Yeah, I mean, the coach is supposed to take that off the best player's plate so he doesn't have to worry about it. Like, what was amazing to me is not only Michael Jordan, I mean, as far as the X's and O's of basketball are concerned, a beautiful mind. I mean, you heard him talk about Brian Russell, you know, plays defense on his toes. So if he made, you know, a head and shoulder fake one way, then, you know, Brian Russell would keep going and he'd be able to create his own shot. Or, you know, they had run that play to Karl Malone a couple different times. And, you know, he didn't realize that Jordan was on the weak side. He steals the ball. Like, not only is he a beautiful mind like that, but he was also, you know, capable of knowing, you know, that these guys aren't me. Steve Kerr is not me. Scottie Pippen is not me. You know, Dennis Rodman is not me. So I have to get all these guys prepared through the practices to be ready for what's in store once we hit the biggest moments. The most adversity, these guys will be ready because I'll have them ready. Well, most players don't want to deal with that.
How excited was Steve Kerr when Jordan pointed to him at a timeout and told him to be ready?
He was funny, too.
He's
a good guy. I like Steve Kerr.
He really is, man. He comes off looking really good in this docuseries. But, I mean, Jordan pointed to him in the timeout and said, be ready. And Steve Kerr was like, I'll be ready.
I know,
I'll be
so
ready.
Funny.
I'll be ready.
Because Steve Kerr's recollection of it was exactly accurate, right? It was like Michael Jordan behind the Gatorade cup being like, Steve, listen, I'm going to pass the ball over to you. And he's like, okay, I'll do that. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Give me the shot. I can do that for you. And that's 25 years ago, and he remembered it exactly the same. That was very well done.
But the recall by Steve Kerr when he was playing with the Cavs and he had a chance to actually look at John Paxson's role, and he said, if I'm going to make it in the NBA, that's what I have to be. And then to ultimately end up having the opportunity to play with the Bulls and be that guy, be the next John Paxson for Michael Jordan. I mean, that just shows you his level of awareness. But I think that Michael Jordan made sure that all his teammates understood their role and the part that they had to play in continuing that dynastic run. And that's one of the things that leadership is responsible for doing. And that's a role that Michael Jordan expected. That's the responsibility, the burden that he put on himself. So it wasn't about him just being the best basketball player that he could be, but it's also about him being the best leader and motivator. I mean, to have the mental capacity to be able to do all of those things, it's no wonder Michael Jordan couldn't focus on anything else. Like, it took all of his being in order to pull off what he pulled off.
You know what was amazing, too? And this was kind of, I mean, he mentioned it as he's sitting in front of the piano and they're asking him questions about, you know, what's going to happen next year. And he's like,
by the way, how crazy is that to win a championship and have the press in your room while you're playing the piano doing an interview?
Yeah, how about that? Now Gus has the trash bag of his suit. Like, he just goes back with it. They all just go back with their uniforms on and the champagne and everything else. But, I mean, that's, Dave, when you really think about what made him great and his ability, you know, to hit the big shot and, you know, if you had, I mean, how many times have you heard, okay, you know, you're playing a game for your life. You could pick one player. Who would it be? And everyone always picks Jordan for obvious reasons. But that's the hardest thing to do sometimes in sports is to not think, you know, to always put yourself in the moment, right? Like, biggest moments, put yourself in that moment. Don't worry about, you know, what happens, you know, if you miss the shot. Or, you know what I mean? Like, that's a gift, man. A lot of people can't do stuff like that.
But, I mean, you guys were in professional sports. How many guys, I mean, what percentage of guys would you say want the ball in the biggest moment? Not a lot.
I think every player will tell you that they want the ball. They want it to be on them. But not a lot of guys truly want that responsibility. But it feels like that was something that Michael Jordan embraced routinely.
Loved it.
Like, they said that was his gift. It wasn't his athletic ability. It wasn't his ability to play basketball. It was his ability to be present and to not worry about past failures. Michael Jordan said it last night. Why would I worry about a shot I haven't even taken yet? That did not make sense to him. And he played that way. Like, you could actually see it. Like, they're in the Delta Center out in Utah, and they're shooting around during practice, and Michael Jordan's trying to win the contest to take a shot from the bench. Like, it's just, it's one of those things where he didn't worry about failure because he was so busy focusing on the success that he was having.
But that's a tough mindset to have.
It is, but when you put in that kind of work, when you see how Jordan dedicated himself to being the best basketball player he could be behind the scenes, it's no wonder he was so confident because he believed nobody worked harder than him.
And he's right.
He's absolutely right. Now, I don't know how he did it. He's getting on the team playing, and he's got his cigar, and he's got his glass full of oil sitting there on the plane playing cards. Like, I just couldn't believe that that's actually what professional sports teams did when they traveled. We seem like we're so far removed from that, but it's amazing to see that side of him, but then see him clock in for work and then see the level of intensity that he had, not just in the games, but in the preparation for the games. Like, that's to me what makes him special. That's what separates him from everybody else. It's easy to have intensity when you got 20,000 fans screaming or booing you. But to have that level of intensity at a shoot-around or at a practice, it's hard to do.
See, it wasn't even the level of intensity that impressed me the most. I mean, I was the complete opposite. Like, I was a nervous wreck. Like, I couldn't stop thinking about, you know, what happens if, you know, there's a breakaway or two-on-one going through my mind over and over. Like, by the time the game started, I was so mentally worn out because I had gone through every situation 1,000 times. Like, you got him, you know, on the training table in his full suit taking a nap, or you have him, you know, sitting around in his suit talking to Ahmad Rashad before a huge game, or someone walks in talking and he's lacing up his shoes. That was one of my favorite lines last night. He's lacing up his shoes, and it was the guy, Tex. Those are the right shoes you want to be sliding around. He goes, slide a ring on your finger. That's what I'm going to do. Like, it's just no, but like, I mean, Marty Brodeur was like that. I used to ask Marty Brodeur all the time, like, you know, how do you get ready for a game? He's like, I just go to the rink. I have my Sprite. I put my gear on and I go play. Because, like, in his mind, there was never this fear of failure, right? Because they put so much into it, and they had this supreme confidence that they could just be at ease before it was time to really ratchet it up when the game started.
But that's got to be in your DNA, no? That's just something that you have, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't have it. I mean, I wish I did have it. I mean, some guys are just blessed with that, or it's just, I mean, it's just because they put so much work into what they do, and they just have the supreme confidence that allows them to be like that. But I mean, I could never be that way. Never.
And then we got to see a lot of the flu game last night also, or the food poisoning game, or whatever you want to call it. That was one, what was it, 10:30 night, one pizza place in all of Salt Lake City is open. They drop off a pie with five guys, you know, staring into the room of Michael Jordan. He eats it, wakes up, sick
of the insinuation. I mean, wasn't the insinuation that they did something to the pizza?
Of course that's the insinuation. Yeah. Of course.
You got to track those five guys down. I want to know what was on that pizza.
Yeah, if it's five guys and it's not a burger, I'm not interested. Like, it's just, to me, to me, like, the absurdity that you're talking about a professional sports team staying at a hotel that doesn't have room service? Think about that, Dave. 10:30
yeah,
at night.
It's unbelievable.
We have no room service? Like what are we doing? Like, it's just, to me, that's crazy. But I mean, listen, he went out there and he felt like he had a responsibility. Like, he talked to his mom and she thought it was crazy that he would try to go out there and play. And he goes out there and drops 45 or whatever it was. Like, that's unbelievable. He's hooked up to he's hooked up to an IV before the game. And people are wondering whether or not he's going to play. Phil Jackson is asking him, can he play? And there was no question in his mind that he was going to play.
And you see, he did not look well. I mean, he was drenched in sweat. He looked sick as a dog, and yet he persevered. It's amazing to think about it, because we've all had the flu or been sick where you have like 102 and you can't get out of bed. You can't even think about going to get the mail. The thought of getting dressed, getting on the bus and getting to a game would be overwhelming for most players. He goes out there and then dominates and comes up with the big shots. It's remarkable.
But Dave, Bob Costas said it last night. He said he took his mind to a different place. And that was what enabled him to go out there and have that kind of performance. Like Michael Jordan, it was truly mind over matter. And it didn't matter that he wasn't feeling well. Like he was going to go out there and he was going to play well. It was just watching him hustle on both ends of the court in that game, knowing what that was going to have to take, knowing how he probably felt. How could you not be impressed by that?
You have to be. It's unbelievable.
That's the definition of a gutsy performance. Literally, after throwing up his guts the night before, goes out there and spills his guts on the court.
Yep.
I mean, but don't we say that all the time, though? I mean, what separates good from great is the mental aspect of the game and how superior he was mentally than everybody else. Like what he was capable of doing, his mindset. And there's only probably a handful of people that can put themselves in the mental space that Michael Jordan was capable of doing on a consistent basis. I mean, it was crazy.
And Pippen in that game 6 of 98 was pretty impressive, too, because he could not even walk.
With his back?
Yeah, but Pippen comes off to me in this series looking not so good, guys. I guess some of the shine for me is worn off of Scottie Pippen. Like, you had the back thing. You had the migraines in that series. I think it was against the Cavs. I mean, you had the contract situation and him not wanting to go into the game after Phil Jackson draws up the play with Kukoc. Then he doesn't get the surgery at the start of the offseason. He waits until the start of the 98 season. Like, there's just a whole bunch of things in this docuseries that makes Scottie Pippen look a little bit selfish to me.
Well, they get the missed free throws. I mean, then you had
bad shots.
I don't know if it was intentional, but I think Chris is right. It was almost like Scottie Pippen is great and he's one of the greatest players of all time, but I think that Michael Jordan wanted to make sure that everyone realized.
Like, it was clear that Scottie Pippen was the Robin to Michael Jordan's
but
Batman.
But did we need to do that? Like Michael Jordan's Michael Jordan.
Did you hear his Hall of Fame speech?
Yeah.
Stop.
But I don't know. That's not a great look. To be the guy that has to get all the shine and can't give others credit is not a great look for Michael Jordan.
Yeah, isn't that always the argument, though? Now, I mean, come on, let's face it. Part of the release of this documentary, and someone has said this a couple different times, was that as soon as LeBron wins that championship for Cleveland and says now he's now the greatest, it kind of incentivized Michael to retell
that
the story.
That was, so Ramona Shelburne reported it, that was like the moment they won. It's like, all right, let's get my doc going.
Exactly right. So what is the, if you love LeBron James and think he's the best player of all time, one of the things you always use against Michael Jordan is that he had Scottie Pippen. Right? He has Scottie Pippen. LeBron James hasn't had Scottie Pippen. So now what this does is kind of let you in and see, oh yeah, he had Scottie Pippen, but he was a flawed guy. Yeah, he was a flawed guy, and Michael Jordan was head and shoulders above, what Scottie Pippen ever was.
That could be true, but he's still not winning those championships without Scottie Pippen.
No, I don't disagree with you, but I mean, some of the stuff he said too, like, I mean, when Dennis Rodman needed a break, Dennis Rodman needs a break. I'm carrying this team. If anyone needs a break, I need a break. Or in that game, when or he's like, Phil Jackson had asked me if I could play 48 minutes. I told him I could play 40, whatever I need. I needed to carry the team because we didn't have Pip. Like, he always like makes a point that, okay, yeah, it's great to have Pip, but I mean, I'm the guy.
Yeah, and that was evidenced in this documentary, that he was the guy, and Pippen was terrific, but Pippen was a very flawed human and a very flawed player at times.
It was almost like, I made Pippen Pippen. You know what yeah. I mean?
I think he believes that.
I think that's true. I think that's absolutely true. Like, without Michael Jordan there to push Scottie Pippen, there's no telling what kind of player Scottie Pippen would have developed into. He might have been a fine player, an all-star caliber player, but Scottie Pippen might not be the top 50 guy that we know him as today.
I think that's fair.
Without Michael Jordan being there to push him.
I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I mean, he pushed everybody to that.
Yeah.
I almost would guarantee that if you asked all these guys, were you better with Jordan or when you went elsewhere and played without him, that they would say they were better with him. He just had this tenacity and will to make guys better. He forced them to be better.
Well, Dave, after that 98 season, none of those guys on that team were any semblance of the players that we knew them as Chicago Bulls once they went elsewhere. After that season, like, I think it was Scottie Pippen averaged 11.5 points per game in his career after that point. Dennis Rodman, I think he kind of fell off the map. Like, none of those guys were ever the same. So I think it's something to be said about Michael Jordan bringing out the best in all of those guys, because he set a standard that everybody tried to live up to. Like, he was effective as a leader in that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost reminiscent of Tom Brady, where you look at some of the receivers he had. It's like, mm-hmm. he made Troy Brown good. Yep. He made Deion Branch a Super Bowl MVP, and then yep. he got a big deal elsewhere, and then he was never the same guy. Like, greats enable other people around them to be better. They will them, they push them, they force them to be the best version of themselves.
Yeah, and sometimes that's against their will. Like, Michael Jordan was going to take everybody with him kicking and screaming. I mean, if you didn't like it, it was going to be, in his own words, hell for you. But that's the kind of culture that they created, and that's what allowed them to have, at that time, unprecedented success.
But I think it also points out, when you start talking about dynastic teams, is how important that relationship is between your best player and the head coach, and the buy-in from that best player. I mean, think of what Phil did. I mean, you go from Michael Jordan, right, greatest of all time. Mm-hmm. He completely buys into what you're selling. And by the way, you don't have to be the bad guy, because Michael Jordan's already going to be the bad guy and push everyone. So you got that. And then he goes from there to the guy who wants to be Michael Jordan, and Kobe Bryant.
Right.
Wins 5 championships with Kobe Bryant. I mean, Bill Belichick, Tom Brady. Tom Brady completely buys into Bill Belichick. You know, Tim Duncan completely buys into Greg Popovich. Like, that is a vital relationship to have that kind of success consistently. Vital.
100%. If you don't have the best player buy into what the coach is selling, or the two of them working in conjunction, you're probably not going to win.
Exactly right. And I think that's part of the reason. I mean, Phil was a disaster here with the Knicks. I mean, because he'd never done the job before, wasn't great at it, maybe wasn't motivated outside of the money. But, I mean, you know, having watched this documentary and seeing how smart Phil was with dealing with personalities, you know, understanding what motivated people. I mean, that whole coffee can thing I thought was unbelievable at the end. Like, he was a master manipulator as far as, you know, the mental aspect of the game was concerned. I mean, do you not believe now that when he took over the Knicks that he was all set with Carmelo Anthony, knowing that Carmelo Anthony was never going to buy into what he was going to try to sell him?
Of course. But he was forced to keep Carmelo Anthony.
So again, I mean, destined to fail right from the beginning. I mean, you have, you know, this, you've won 11 championships where your star player buys into what you're selling and then, you know, passes it on to the team. And now your best player has no interest in what you're trying to preach.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think you're right, Rick, and it starts with having mutual respect for one another. Like, you have to have that in place between the head coach, the decision maker, and the star player. Like, if you don't have that mutual respect, it's going to be hard to have any kind of success. And I think that's what you saw with Phil Jackson here at the Knicks. But it's also an example of it in the affirmative when you watch Phil Jackson's years with the Lakers and the Bulls. And so, I mean, it was clear that Michael Jordan had a love, had a respect, had an admiration for Phil Jackson's approach and Phil Jackson's ability to set the agenda for the team. Like, Phil Jackson having a theme for every single season that he was the head coach of the Chicago Bulls, like, even down to 98, which was the last dance. Because everybody realized that because of Jerry Krause, this was probably going to be their last opportunity to be together and to compete for a championship. Now, I thought it was interesting at the end of it where Reinsdorf calls Phil Jackson after the celebration in Grant Park, and he says, you know, you have the opportunity to come back in 99 if you want to be the head coach. And Phil Jackson says, I'm all set. I thought the docuseries ending like that with it being up in the air and Jordan feeling like they were robbed of a chance to compete for a fourth straight title, I think that question will always be out there. Could the Bulls have ran it back and won another championship? I know in a lot of minds, people would believe that they could have done it.
It's hard to go against them, I'll tell you that.
And I think Michael Wilbon made the point that 99 season was a shortened season. It was like 50-something games, right?
Yeah, 50. That's when the Knicks were the 8th seed, and they went to the Miami on that Allen Houston floater on the Sunday afternoon, yep.
So, I mean, you mean to tell me that veteran team led by Michael Jordan wouldn't have had a chance to win four straight?
It's hard-pressed to say that they wouldn't have gotten by the Knicks and gone to the NBA Finals, right?
Agreed.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, they would have probably gone back again. Now, that Spurs team was good. That would have been an entertaining series in 99. But, yeah, I think they would have at least gotten back. Today on ESPN Daily, Michael Jordan's relentless drive and work ethic are constant themes in The Last Dance. Wright Thompson looks for the roots of the greatness in Jordan's family history and his upbringing. That's ESPN Daily. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcast. You know what's a great testament to this documentary, Rick? It was 10 hours, which is a long time. It's a lot of television to watch. It finishes and you want more. That's how good this was.
Oh, it was that good, and the timing of it was perfect. I mean, with no live sports,
right.
It gave you something to look forward to every single Sunday.
Right. But how many times do you watch or feel like you're forced into watching? You're like, all right, is this over? I never once did I feel like that. Like, would this just end? Would this episode end? Would this night be over? Can we get through 8 and 9 and get to 10? Like, I never felt like that.
No, I found myself wanting more. I mean, I wasn't done. You know how much I hate staying up late. Like, even when the second episode was over, I was like, okay, I need more. I still need more.
Well, you're not going to get more.
It's amazing that they didn't finish the last episode until this past Thursday. That's unbelievable.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, they didn't finish episode 10 until Thursday. Jason Aaron was on with SVP last night and talked about it. Like, they had an idea about how things would go. Like, they decided the content that would be in all 10 episodes, I think he said almost 2 years ago, but it was just a matter of being able to fill all of it out and edit it and put it together. And he said they didn't finish episode 10 until this past Thursday.
That's amazing.
Because it wasn't scheduled to air until June, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So they thought they had time. We'll get to the calls in a second. Let's listen to Jason Aaron discussing that on SVP.
Had been sitting in a dark edit room for over 2 years with this material and seen especially the earlier episodes before the quarantine. I think we had 4 done in totality. So we had seen those over and over and over again. No jokes were funny to us. No moments were new to us. Right. No songs were fresh to us. This one is a little bit different, these two tonight, because we just finished these episodes in the last 8 weeks. And indeed, in episode 10, we just finished on Thursday. So it's a little bit less stale in our minds.
That's great. I love it. So fresh. So good. Excellent. Very well done. All right, let's get to the calls. 800-919-3776. Craig in Morganville. Craig, you're next up on First Up on a Monday at 98.
Hey, guys. I had a question. That episode where Scottie Pippen was ticked off that he wasn't getting the ball for the last play, do you think if Michael was on that team or at any time where he was not getting the ball and he wasn't going to be the guy who makes that crucial shot, do you think he would run roughshod and be pissed off? He wouldn't sit down, but maybe he would run roughshod. Do you think that would happen?
I don't think I could ever imagine Phil Jackson drawing up a play for somebody else if he has Michael Jordan on the bench. I don't think that ever happens.
Ever.
Now, if Michael Jordan gets the ball and he gets double teamed, then he's going to pass it up to the open guy if he trusts that guy. And that's exactly what we saw him do in the 97 finals against the Jazz with Steve Kerr. But Michael Jordan was getting the ball in last shot situations. But I think we also saw throughout this documentary that Scottie Pippen ain't Michael Jordan.
No, but I don't think we needed, I mean, maybe it hammered home the point more, but I don't think we needed the documentary to know that Scottie Pippen was not Michael
Jordan. No, I'm just talking about in terms of Phil Jackson drawing up the last play for the last shot for somebody. Like, it wasn't one of those things where it's like Phil Jackson's like, I got to make sure that Scottie Pippen takes the last shot. I think that Phil probably looked at it and said, well, maybe there might be a better option or better answer in this situation. When you got Michael Jordan, it doesn't matter what situation you're in, he's going to get the ball. That's the difference between the two players.
Yeah. I mean, Kukoc was the better option, and Kukoc hit the shot in that moment.
Yeah, but he had hit several big shots throughout the course of the regular season. So, I mean, it wasn't like Phil didn't have confidence that Kukoc could step up. But I'm just saying, in terms of Phil Jackson determining who should take the last shot. It wasn't a no-brainer like when he had Michael Jordan. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, of course. No, Jordan would have had the shot. Jordan would have had every shot. Now, maybe you could have gone off script, right? Maybe Jordan's double team, he couldn't get the ball to him, or Jordan got the ball and he had to dish it out like he did to Paxson, like he did to Kerr, like he did many times, like he did to Winnington against the Knicks, but they would have gone through Michael Jordan. I believe that.
Agreed.
Yep. All right, continue along. Spike Jersey. Spike, you're next up on 98.7.
Good morning, my friends. It's a mixed emotion this morning. Man, I want more of that. And two pieces of humanity. I know you all felt it, because I know all you guys pretty well. The scenes with Gus were gut-wrenching, and the story about Steve Kerr's father in Lebanon. If you guys didn't well up on that, man, I'm telling you, and I know you all did. The humanity of the side boss were just brilliant, and I felt so bad for Steve Kerr. How he, you know, when his mother said everybody grieves differently, and he got he jumped into the basketball, and then that sadness that just came over me when he made the game-winning shot. I kept thinking if his pops could be there. But it was brilliantly edited. I want more of it. Now there's a dearth of what's new. I don't know how you guys feel, but I got trouble watching auto racing. That's maybe just me, you know. But this was, with all the pain I endured as a Knicks fan, and to think that the Pacers came back the next year and got what, in a short season, and the Knicks wiped them out in six games. So Indiana was never beating the Bulls, and I will insist till my last breath they would have won eight in a row. Have a great week, guys.
All right, appreciate it. Yeah, the Steve Kerr stuff was a lot to handle.
What got to me, Dave, was when Steve said during the national anthem of the games that he played in, he thought about his father, you know, and how he would love Steve playing on that stage. Like, that's the part that got me. Because, I mean, every player knows that feeling. You're getting ready and you hear the national anthem. Like, that's the thing that, like, you reflect on, and you, all the emotions kind of hit you and you know that it's go time. For him to think about his father in that moment, man, that's tough, Dave.
That was heavy stuff.
It really is. But yeah. It's interesting, though. Even with Michael Jordan, like, both of the players threw themselves into sports when they dealt with that personal tragedy. I thought that was interesting. With Steve Kerr, it was basketball. With Michael Jordan, it was baseball. But both of them kind of threw themselves into sports because they really didn't know how to process or deal with it any other way.
And there's not a lot of people out there that their fathers have been murdered. Two guys on the same team have that, and they never really connected over that. It's kind of an interesting aspect of it, right?
Yeah, because Steve Kerr said he thought it would be too painful for them to try to talk about.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine, Dave. I really couldn't.
No.
No.
And Kerr was a young – I mean, he's a kid. He was, what, 19 or 20 years old when it happened?
Yeah. Well, it's tough.
Awful. Yeah, but Dave, also remember, though, in order for them to connect on that level, I mean, Michael Jordan would have to show his teammate, like, authentic.
Right. Let him behind the curtain. Yeah.
Behind the curtain. And who knows? I mean, that wasn't part of his persona. Like, he saved that emotional stuff for, you know, Gus and his, like, close inner circle that weren't his teammates.
And Gus, I don't know if you noticed, he didn't live long after that. They showed the three security guards. I guess Gus died in 2000.
2000, so yeah.
Yeah, a couple of years after the 98 season. Trey in the truck. Trey, you're on 98.7.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Real quick question. I know Rick appreciates random stuff. Rick, did you have any, like, type of relationship or personal relationship with that guy that got paralyzed out of BU? I saw it on TV, and I just thought of you immediately.
Travis Roy?
Yeah, that guy. It was, like, just so sad. And I was like, now, I wonder if Rick, like, knew him or anything like that, because I thought that was way before you. I was just curious about that.
Yeah, he was around. Travis was around, yeah. Yeah,
okay,
great guy.
Okay.
Awesome guy.
Yeah,
wasn't just to let people know that his first shift ever is BU?
First shift. Yeah, his first shift, right? First shift,
right,
first game, his family was there. Yeah.
Yeah, and I just thought of Rick. I just wanted to know if you had any personal connection to him. But real quick, on the Jordan, I just wanted to say, I didn't realize, and now I'm noticing it more because obviously I didn't get to watch Jordan, but it was amazing how many times they were not the number one seed, whether that be in the East or in the finals period, and they won so many road games, like all these clinchers on the road, all these road games in the Eastern Finals, all these road games in the playoffs. And, I just think that, I'm not saying you guys underestimated, but it's just amazing to me to be able to do that such a difficult level with the aggressiveness of the teams and just all these road games was just amazing to win, and obviously he never reached the game seven, so he had a clinch on the road. But I just thought it was just, I didn't realize how many times they were not the number one seed. I mean, I don't know exactly how often it was, but it was pretty cool to just see how they, it didn't matter what seed they got, and it was just amazing to see that. That's all I want.
You know what?
One of the, anywhere.
You know what was interesting though, Dave? One of the things, and this is like when my wife watched Miracle for the first time, she's like at the edge of her seat. I'm like, you know, they win, right? She's like, yeah, but I'm so into the movie. It's like I found myself during this documentary, like, you know, they tell the story of Game Five, and it's one of the final series. They tell the story of Game Five. And I'm like, oh, I wonder what happens. Does this go seven? And then I'd like all of a sudden it hits me like, oh yeah, Michael Jordan didn't go seven games in the finals.
Right, right, right. You know, it's funny you say that because I had the same feeling. And I was watching last night. It's like, oh, and I'm like rooting for you know, Utah or Indiana. I'm like, oh, you know, do they have a chance here? You know, Indiana's up three, right? They said 97-94. And they have the tip between Rick Smits, who's 7-4, and Michael Jordan. It goes out to Curry and hits a three-pointer. And I'm thinking, like, you know, did they possibly win this game? No, of course they didn't win this game. But you have, I don't know, you just reflect on it. You have these thoughts. But that's how enticing the program was.
To me, it was crazy watching that 98 NBA Finals and seeing what the Bulls did to the Jazz in Game 3.
Oh, my God.
54 points.
96-54. The lowest offensive total in the shot clock era, and you do that in the NBA Finals with a championship on the line? You dominate a team like that? That is unbelievable to me. I mean, Michael Jordan didn't only just take the game, he took their pride too. Like, you embarrassed him.
And that Utah team was good.
Well, that Utah team was good, but I think Michael Jordan had a point to prove with Karl Malone as the reigning MVP. He had something to say about that. Like, he wanted to go out there and embarrass the Utah Jazz. And they did it the year before in the NBA Finals, but I guess he felt slighted in some kind of way and, again, put that chip on his shoulder, and they just embarrassed him in that game. Like, at that point, you knew that the series was no longer in doubt. The only question was, how many games is it going to take the Bulls to wrap it up?
Well, it almost went Game 7.
Well, it almost went Game 7. I thought people probably felt like the Bulls could have got it done in Game 5. But then they ended up having to go back out. I mean, they ended up having to take care of business. It took them to a sixth game. But, I mean, I thought people felt like the Chicago Bulls could have taken care of business a little bit earlier in that series. And maybe you could hear the reporters talking about how they felt like it could have been his last game in the United Center. And he says that the job's not done yet, so it's premature to even talk about it. And then they lose that game, and then they have to go back out to Utah. But, I mean, Michael Jordan is... I mean, we're running out of adjectives to describe how great he was. He really was on a different level than everybody else. And to have all of the great players of that time talk about him being the greatest, like there was a consensus among NBA players, not just fans and media, but amongst the players, like this is the star amongst stars. Like he's above everybody else.
Yeah, he always was. He really always was. I mean, you even saw James Worthy said, I was the best player for 2 weeks in North Carolina. And James Worthy was a great player. No, Michael comes in there, and 2 weeks later, he's the best player on the team.
No doubt about it, David. I'm just saying, in the context of team sports, when we have the conversation of who's the greatest of all time, like pretty much in every other sport, you've got a pretty good argument, a pretty good back and forth, except for basketball, where it's LeBron, it's Michael Jordan, and then LeBron James as that second guy, and then it feels like it's everybody else. Like, in watching this docuseries, to me, it feels like Michael Jordan is clearly the best basketball player of all time, and LeBron James is, even though he's closed the gap, I don't think that LeBron James could ever eclipse Michael Jordan. Maybe he could tie. I don't know. His career still hasn't finished yet, but I just don't see anything out there that LeBron James could do to eclipse what Michael Jordan meant to the game of basketball and what he meant to the culture.
It just doesn't feel amongst his peers, I mean, at that time, that there was ever any doubt. As opposed to now, I mean, year to year, you'll have, you know, players in the NBA say, you know, Kevin Durant's the best player. Or, you know, there's always a conversation. When Michael Jordan was, I mean, in his prime, it was known throughout the NBA that he was, by the best players, that Michael Jordan was the best player.
Yeah, he was the guy.
It wasn't even a question. Like, even before, I mean, this was like, even before he started winning MVPs. I mean, he scored 63 against the Celtics. Like, even that Celtics team realized that Michael Jordan's the best player in the NBA.
Right. They just had nothing along with him at that point.
Exactly right.
Yeah, he was. I mean, he was running solo then.
I'm one of the. He's probably the greatest scorer of all time. Like one of the greatest leaders of all time. And I will say this though. I mean, it's Spike talking about, you know, would they win their seventh championship if he had stayed? Would they have won eight? I just think everything happened perfectly for a reason. Like, I don't know. I mean, if he doesn't retire and go play baseball, like, mentally, could he have handled, you know, after winning those three, another run?
I don't know. I don't know.
You know what I'm saying?
You saw at the end of the first three that he was spent. At the end of the second three, it looked like he had nothing left.
Yeah, like, maybe that's exactly what he needed to reignite himself, to get him back to where he needed to be.
Yeah, to remotivate himself. It's true. All right, 800-919-3776.
Because, Dave,
your calls. Yeah, go ahead.
Let's be honest. In the grand scheme of things, right, like, I don't think anything would have taken away from what Michael Jordan is or what he was at the time. But, I mean, let's face it. The fact that he's 6-for-6 in the NBA Finals and none of those final series ever, that's
yeah.
It doesn't get any better than that.
No, it's what legends are made of. I love that song. You know what movie that song is from?
Karate Kid.
That's right. Terrific movie.
Outstanding movie.
Right?
Didn't need a remake, though.
No.
Yeah.
Daniel LaRusso?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, outstanding.
Excellent movie.
How about this? Here's a quick Karate Kid story. So Ralph Macchio is a huge Islander fan.
Big Islander fan, yep.
Yeah, yeah. So I go into the wise room after one of the games, and Ralph Macchio's in the wise room. Ralph Macchio's handing out autographs in the wise room.
The wives loved them, huh?
Oh, yeah, the kid. Oh, they're just eating it up. He's handing out signed Ralph Macchio cards.
That's funny.
Oh, my goodness.
He looks terrific, too, by the way. And I say that because I'm looking at BJ Armstrong, who's got to be in his 50s right now on First Take. And he looks like he's 35 years old.
Yeah, that's that black don't crack, Dave. Little melanin
remarkable.
Magic right there. Yeah, he's got the whole Benjamin Button thing going.
Yeah.
I mean, had it not been for the gray hair, you wouldn't be able to date him.
If he had dark hair and someone said he's 31, I think you could buy it.
Yeah, if we got him a little bit of that Just for Men.
Yeah.
Fill in the gray. Yeah.
But Macchio's another one.
Is he?
Oh, my. Have you seen Ralph Macchio?
I haven't seen any pictures of him recently.
Rick, correct? Like, Macchio's, he's got to be well into his 50s.
Yeah, I don't know if he's, I wouldn't put him on BJ Armstrong's level. I mean, the skin hasn't held up like BJ's skin's held up.
I'm going to look this up. I tend to disagree. Ralph Macchio
BJ,
looks sensational.
BJ Armstrong's complexion is flawless, dude.
Macchio is now... look at him. He looks unbelievable.
Sweep the leg.
He is now older than Mr. Miyagi was when they filmed the movie. By the way.
That would make sense.
Interesting.
I mean, that would make sense. I do find myself, though, having a hard time...
That makes me feel so old.
How old right. people are. I have a hard time with ages.
You're not good at that?
I'm not great with that.
Well, the worst is when someone will ask you, and then they ask you, and you are wrong, and you guess over.
Or maybe you forget about it. Like, I find myself forgetting sometimes when somebody asks me how old I am, I have to actually think about it.
Start doing the math?
Yeah, that's when it starts to get a little scary.
I always just go way under. Like, if someone asks me the age of a person, I always just go just way under.
Right. It's really almost a no-win. Same with thinking that a woman is pregnant. If you're not 100% sure,
don't make that mistake. No.
Don't say it.
Do not
that happen once. That'll never happen again.
That doesn't surprise me at all. Does not, because again, you're socially awkward.
I'm not socially awkward. I was congratulating her. Just she wasn't pregnant.
When's your baby due?
Yeah.
Not pregnant.
That was rough.
This is actually a food baby, huh?
Awkward.
A Krispy Kreme baby. Jerk. All right, let's bring him in. Andy and Merrick. Andy, we know you've got good questions. Let's hear what they are.
Good morning, guys. I got three questions and a bonus Steve Kerr-related question if we have time.
Ooh, a bonus.
All right, 99.
What's up, Andy?
Your first coach, currently 78 years old. Dwayne Charles Parcells. I want to know what college he went to and what pro team he was drafted by.
What college he went to?
Mm-hmm.
Did he go to Army?
No, he was a coach at Army. But
okay, he started at Air Force, correct?
Air Force was down the road. I think Air Force was his last job before
okay.
before
he moved
the
to
Giants,
the Giants,
right?
Okay, yeah. All right.
He was a wheat shocker, I believe. No?
He was a Wichita State shocker, Dave.
Yeah. Ah, Wichita State. How about that?
And do you know what team he was drafted by in the NFL's seventh round?
No one wants to go there.
Have
Detroit Lions.
No one wants to go there.
Yep, Detroit Lions.
Okay.
You got it. All right, Rick. You ready?
I'm ready, buddy. Let's be gentle. It's Monday.
Oh, this is an all-timer here. Nice Hall of Fame defenseman question.
I'm dealing with a flood, so be nice.
NHL's all-time plus-minus leader with a whopping 722 is 140 plus-minus points ahead of Bobby Orr. Name this Hall of Fame defenseman.
Hall of Fame defenseman, was this guy I'm thinking about, did he coach at some point too?
Yeah.
He definitely did.
Yeah, it's Larry Robinson.
You got it.
Yes.
Nice.
Yes, baby.
Nice. So beautiful. Quick. Robust. Wonderful.
Speaking of hockey, David.
Oh, come on. Why do I get hockey?
Come on, Dave.
Because it's a Ranger question. You should come up with this. No pressure.
Yeah.
As you know, Emil Francis ranks number one in the Rangers in wins.
Mm-hmm.
But he only ranks number two in winning percentage. Can you tell me the Ranger coach with the best regular season winning percentage?
Mike Keenan.
That would be correct.
Yes. Yes!
How easy was that?
That was a layup.
Well, this...
Did you know that was a layup, Andy, or did my genius just jump out at you?
That was a layup. So let's see if your genius can come through with this. All three of you. 1987-88 Arizona Wildcats.
Oh.
Steve Kerr was one of five future NBA players. However, my question is, what future Major League Baseball All-Star...
Kenny Lofton.
You didn't even let me finish the question.
Wow, why would I let you finish when I know the answer?
Okay, then who were the future NBA All-Stars on that?
Oh, now you're gonna double up the question.
I'm going to double down. Who were the future NBA players?
Sean Elliott?
Yes.
Tom Tolbert?
Yes.
Anthony Cook?
One of them was a Bull.
What happened?
One of them was a Bull. It was featured in the series.
Judd Bushler?
That's it.
Anthony Cook.
You got it. Oh, my God. Dave, you're on fire.
I slept well last night.
I am the smartest man alive!
Thank you, Andy.
Stay healthy, guys.
As always, we appreciate it.
That was some of your best work, I'm going to be honest.
That was good stuff,
That's
right?
Unbelievable. Dude.
Yeah. Because there was no, I mean, the Google GIMP is fast. The Google GIMP is not that fast.
No.
The GIMP is not, I mean, especially coming
I didn't even have to use Google on that one.
No, it's because, no. Listen, the GIMP is probably tired.
Well, he's
weekend.
A GIMP. By definition, he moves slowly, doesn't he?
That's a good point.
Okay. Yeah.
He's gimping around. Is that why they call him the Gimp, though? I don't feel like that's why they get this. Is the speed why they call him the Gimp?
I always thought it was. No,
really?
Yeah,
I have to look that up.
Gimp is a noun and a verb. What, I mean, I don't understand
meaning of.
You word. Look that up. We'll take a break. Okay. Come back.
How do you
get
spell
to the calls.
Is Gimp with an I?
I would think it was GIMP. No.
Yeah, meaning of. There it is. Pop right up.
All right, give us the definition when we return.
DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg, weekdays at 10 on 98.7 ESPN.